Call the House Committee on State and Federal Affairs to order Tuesday, July 26, 2005. We are going to start at the top of the agenda and pretty much go down through it in order. Open a public, no, just a work session on Senate Bill 548A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 548A modifies the crime of interfering with a peace officer in response to a Oregon Supreme Court and Court of Appeals decision in 2004 that struck down portions of the existing interfering with a peace officer statute because they were constitutionally overbroad. There are two amendments pending before the committee. I'm going to start with the easy one. The -A6 amendment, if adopted by the committee, resolves conflicts with House Bill 3379, which amended the interfering with a peace officer statute to include probation, parole, and post-prison supervision officers. The -A5 amendment, if adopted, would add portions of bills that I think most members of this committee have seen before. House Bill 2020, which changes the definition of human being to include unborn child for purposes within the criminal statutes, specifically amending the aggravated murder statute, the murder statute, manslaughter in the first and second degrees, and criminally negligent homicide. It further creates the crime of assault of an unborn child. It also includes House Bill 2828A, which amended murder and assault in the first degree statutes when those crimes were committed by an intoxicated driver and that intoxicated driver had either previously caused the death or serious physical injury of a person while driving under the influence of intoxicants or had three prior convictions for driving under the influence of intoxicants. It also includes House Bill 2974A, which provided a mechanism for victim notification when an individual was going to be released from custody if that custody was in the care of a hospital. And basically what was happening was criminal cases occasionally get dismissed because a defendant is unable to aid and assist by virtue of a mental illness. And what happens is a district attorney's office and a defense attorney will occasionally make an agreement that that individual will be civilly committed instead. And so victims of the underlying crime were not being notified when those people were being released. So this would provide a mechanism for victim notification in those situations. It also adds portions from 3469A, which created the new crimes of unlawfully being in a location where children regularly congregate and unlawful contact with a child. That was to address individuals who were sexually violent, dangerous offenders, predatory sex offenders, or dangerous offenders if their underlying conviction was a sex crime. Finally, it adds a new provision that no one has, that it has not been before any committees. And that is, it creates a new provision of law in cases of post-conviction relief that requires certain findings before the petitioner can subpoena the victim. And what's been happening is, in these cases, a petitioner in a post-conviction relief was a defendant in a criminal case that has been convicted. And usually post-conviction relief actions are based on incompetence of counsel or inappropriate behavior by a prosecutor. But what they were finding was defendants were subpoenaing the crime victim of the underlying crime for no reason other than, or the proponents would assert, for no reason other than to re-victimize the victim. The victim was unable to bring any information that would assist in the post-conviction relief case. So this would require the court to find that the victim has new information, that information would be helpful to the petitioner's case before the petitioner can bring the victim in and cause the victim to undergo a deposition. And that's it?
That's it. Senator Pogarski, what happened to your simple bill?
It picked up a little bit on the way. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm here at the request of the chair to kind of just give an overview on the Senate Bill 548A, and I would note that A6 is the one that you would be wanting to look at regarding maintaining the bill as it is. Understand that the A5s are something else that's going to be discussed, and I will not be making comment on those. As counsel said, the reason that 548 was brought forward, I think it was 97, had a bill dealing with interfering with a police officer, and we actually added in as one of the components to it was failure to obey the order of an officer. And the courts ruled that that was too broad and vague, and they basically took that part of the statute and ruled it to be unconstitutional. So 548 was brought forward to make a fix based on what the courts had done, and that's what the A6 will do. My understanding from hearing what counsel says and based on the language that's included, there is a potential conflict with House Bill 3379, and that's why you have Section 1A. In my discussions and my work as a police commissioner for the City of Eugene, and also working with other individuals and as a prosecutor, it was determined that we needed to clean up the statute to make certain that what the courts had ruled to be unconstitutional, we should take that off the books. And that was the intent of 548A. And now would ask you to consider maintaining that part, 548A6. Mr. Chair, the only other thing I would say is, of course, we feel in the area of law enforcement, this is a tool that's necessary, one that's reasonable, and one that gives clarity, because it actually takes out, as I said, the failure to obey a lawful order of a police officer, parole officer, or a probation officer, and instead puts in place what the actual conduct that would be prohibited, such as remaining or entering into a crime scene that has been designated by a police officer without their permission, and also interfering with an officer who's in the process investigating a crime or a traffic collision. As you can imagine, when you have an officer that's trying to do their job, he or she, when they are being interfered with because people either are going across the tape of a crime scene, or if it was out in an accident where they've closed the roads and you're trying to conduct the investigation of needing to be, let's say, diverted from what your primary purpose should be in dealing with individuals, it takes away the time and, in fact, can actually jeopardize a crime scene and evidence. That's the reason for that. The only other thing I will mention, Mr. Chair, based on what I've heard counsel state, that's the other pickups for Dash 5A. I'm not sure if that means that this bill would need to then go to budget because of the potential impact it may have, but if it does, I'd ask you to take that in consideration as it pertains to A6, which we know it does not.
Okay, thank you. Committee member, do you have any questions of the senator? Thank you very much.
Heidi, did you just specifically describe the Dash 14?
I did. Mr. Chair, I move the A6 into Senate Bill 548A.
Does she have to do the A5 first?
I don't think so. I think you can do it out of order.
Okay. Representative Boquist has moved the A6 amendments into Senate Bill 548. Any discussion, objections? Okay, they're in.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A5 amendment into Senate Bill 548.
Representative Boquist has moved the A5 amendments into Senate Bill 548. Any discussion, objections? Representative McPherson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I do object to the A5 amendments. It's a combination of a lot of different ideas here kind of late in the session, a number of which I'm a strong supporter of. In fact, two of the bills that are being combined here, bills that I carried on the floor of the House, and another one is one that I voted for. But it does include additional material, including the contents of Senate of House Bill 2020, which took one particular approach to what everybody recognizes is a terrible event, which is when somebody kills a woman who is pregnant. And I think if there's a common sense reaction on everybody's part, when shared in common, of revulsion at that kind of crime. But there are different solutions to that problem. There's one that's actually been proposed elsewhere in the legislative process here, which would identify killing a pregnant woman with carrying a viable fetus as a category of aggravated murder subject to a mandatory life sentence. And I think that that would be the right solution to this rather than what was already debated on the floor of the House in House Bill 2020. So I'm going to be object to the amendments and will be a no on the bill because of if we move it with the contents of House Bill 2020 in it.
Okay. Any other comments, objections? Okay, the A5s are in. His objection was noted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 548 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 548A as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any discussions on that?
I'm going to join my colleague in objecting to the 2020 language. I can't support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. So noted. Call the roll, please.
Okay. Representative Barker?
No.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 548A is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass. Yeah. And I have Representative Flores and Boquist co-carry, please.
Hey, Mr. Chair, a certain notice of possible minority report.
So noted. Anything further? Close the work session on 548. We will be moving over and not dealing today with 572 and be going to Senate Bill 660, a open a work session.
Friggin'.
And Mr. Moore, can you tell us about the bill quickly?
Yes, Mr. Chair. SB 660 requires county board or local boundary commissions to approve petitions for formation of special districts and clarifies the rules.
And we had a public hearing last week on that,
yeah,
right?
Public hearing on 720.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 660 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 660 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 660 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation and place it on the consent calendar. Close the work session on Senate Bill 660. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1068A.
Help.
We have a problem with revolving staff.
And lawyers are always slow, Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson accepted, though.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my apologies. Senate Bill 1068A was before you last week on the 26th. There are no amendments. This is the bill that would require a peace officer to arrest a person without a warrant if the officer has probable cause to believe that the person has been charged with an offense, is presently on pretrial release pursuant to a release agreement, and that the person has failed to comply with what is called a no contact order pursuant to that release agreement. We had testimony last week from the Oregon District Attorneys Association with respect to why the change is needed. Current law only applies this must arrest with probable cause that there's a violation of a release agreement only currently applies to a limited number of domestic violence offenses. This would expand the scope of this rule to any offense for which there's a security agreement with a no contact order.
Okay. I can recall, I believe I was out of the room when that was held and Representative Boquist was chairing. Representative McPherson, do you have any comments on that bill?
No, I don't.
You're not speechless.
I know how surprising that is. No, I was distracted by something here, so I actually didn't hear the last of the interchange here. So
I believe it was a good bill.
I think that's right.
Still is.
I think so.
We haven't messed with it.
I'm willing to believe that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, move Senate Bill 1068A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1068 to the floor with a due pass. Any further discussion, objections? Call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Bolfus?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Joe Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 1068 moves the floor to do pass. And Representative McPherson, would you carry, please?
Happy to. Thank you.
Close the work session at 1068 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1067.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1067 is also an Oregon District Attorneys Association bill. This is the measure that would expand the crime of telephonic harassment to include the sending or leaving text messages, voicemails, or any other message to another phone, knowing that the caller has been forbidden from doing so by the person who's exercising lawful authority over the receiving telephone. There was an amendment proposed at the time of our last hearing on the 26th that was presented via Representative Boquist on behalf of the Collectors Association is the Dash 1 amendment. That amendment would have provided an exemption for any person who was acting to collect a debt. That we had discussion over that. The representative of ODAA, Deputy District Attorney Gina Skinner, and Sybil Hebb expressed opposition to that, and I made a recommendation at that time that the exemption could be recrafted as an affirmative defense. So there are two additional amendments before you that are versions of this proposed affirmative defense for debt collectors. The Dash 2 was a result of conversations between Mr. Marquis and Ms. Hebb. The Dash 2 would create an affirmative defense if the defendant is a debt collector as defined by statute, and it would specifically, however, not apply in circumstances where the debt collector threatens physical harm upon the debtor or the debtor's family or the debtor's property. Then there's a Dash 3 amendment, which if I had been left without further direction from the committee after last week I obtained, which is a little more narrow than the Dash 2. It could be considered a little more broad even, but this would create an affirmative defense if the defendant is a debt collector as defined by statute who is engaged in lawful debt collection activities. The reason that I believe the debt collectors are opposed to the Dash 3 is that the term lawful debt collection activity opens up liability if it at least excludes them from asserting the affirmative defense if there's any evidence that the debt collector violated any of the several state and federal civil regulations regarding debt collection activity, such as threatening physical violence, threatening to put a lien on property where one has no legal right to, calling after 9 o'clock at night, I believe, was an example cited by Mr. Cosgrove. Nevertheless, those are unlawful debt collection activities. And the reason that the Dash 2 came about between Mr. Marquis and Ms. Hebb was that they were looking to identify the most egregious unlawful debt collection activity, which under the statute is the actual threat of physical harm, and clarify that that is the only one where if there's evidence of that, that affirmative defense is not available to the debt collector.
Any members have any comments, questions on the bill?
I do, Mr. Chair. Council, do those other restrictions on the debt collection activities, like hour of day and threats, whatever the conduct is, are there penalty structures in place under those statutes that can be pursued if a debt collector violates those statutes?
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, there absolutely are, and under there, I believe there are separate statutes with respect to the remedies under state and federal law. Under state law, the civil penalties are identified at 646-642, and I believe that it provides for monetary compensation, attorney's fees. I believe there's even some punitive damage provision that shall not exceed more than $25,000 per violation. Those, to clarify, are civil penalties for violations of unlawful debt collection practices under Oregon Law, Chapter 646.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, I move the A2 amendments into SB 1067.
Representative Boquist has moved the A3,
the dash twos
into Senate Bill 1067. Any objections? They're in.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1067 to the floor as amended to do pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1067 as amended to the floor of the due pass. Any discussion? Objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 1067 as amended moves the floor of the due pass. And Representative Barker, would you carry, please? Open work session on House Bill 3505.
Mr. Chair, HB 3505 provides a public body may condemn property only if primary purpose for taking property is to allow property to be owned, maintained, occupied, or used by public for public purposes. Specifies the conveyance of condemned properties to private party is not public purpose. Exempts condemnation of certain properties, declares emergency effective on passage. Several amendments are presented for the committee's consideration. The recommendations are exceptions to the general rule under Section 2, subparagraph 1 of the bill. Amendments in your packet, they consider dash 3, dash 4, dash 5, dash 6, dash 7, dash 8, dash 9, dash 10, and 12.
Okay. Senator Starr, did you want to testify on this bill?
I'm just here to watch, hopefully. We do have counsel here to explain your
okay. And who's our counsel?
Okay. What's that?
Who do you think it is? Mr. Hendricks, can you tell us what these amendments do, please?
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, acting legislative counsel. I'll start with the dash 3 and work my way through very quickly. The dash 3 amendments would add timber crops, topsoil, gravel to fixtures as the type of things that can be incidentally sold as part of a condemnation without the prohibition on taking for private use being run afoul of. I mean, that the whole point of the bill is prevent public body condemning property just to turn it over to a private entity. This would say the fact that I think this is DOT specifically would take timber crops, et cetera, in addition to fixtures, that they'd be able to sell those without, even though they knew they were going to be selling, it would not violate the provisions in the bill. Property condemned pursuant to 367.818, as I remember, is also a DOT condemnation provision, and it was basically designed to exempt the DOT to make sure we had a full list of the Department of Transportation condemnation provisions for the exemption. Dash 4 is more substantive. It changes the operative provision of the bill, which is Section 2, Sub 1. The language changed here was to get rid of some language that concerned many people. The bill currently indicates that the public body has to take it for the purposes of owning, maintaining, occupying, and using the property. And The dash 4 amendment shortens that list to simply owned and used, because there was concern about occupied, what it would mean to occupy it, what it would mean, whether they really have to maintain it, et cetera. So it boils it down to owner used. The second thing it does is to eliminate the concept of public purpose, which was giving a lot of concern to some folks, that because it did indicate in the existing bill that the intent of the the intent of the public body had to be used for the public for public purposes, and there were some people were concerned about that, about whether or not that might add some additional requirements to currently exist. Section 2 eliminates that public purpose language and kind of cuts to the chase and simply says that your primary purpose have to be to take the property so that it can be owned and used by the public, period. And then a second sentence to indicate that the public body's primary purpose may not be the conveyance of the condemned property or an interest of the condemned property to a private party. So that's changing what was originally put in the bill as far as the operative rule that would be followed under this statute. Dash 5 was to address concerns relating to conveyance of a property under, for instance, a trustee for financing purposes. Many times, and this was news to me, that many times public bodies, when they condemn property in order to get the money, in order to pay just compensation, will actually finance it through a bank or other financial institution. And at that time, of course, they do convey the property to the trustee under the trustee. This would say that transfer conveyances for the purposes of financing acquisition doesn't run afoul of the provisions of this statute. The dash 6 was in response to concerns with respect to whether or not our existing exception in the bill for blighted or slum areas was broad enough, since it covered areas in which buildings and improvements are located that are detrimental to the safety or health. And it was pointed out that that would not cover unimproved property where there's perhaps a brownfield or other environmental contamination. So dash 6 would add another exception that would talk about and addresses unimproved real property that constitutes a danger to the safety, health, and welfare of the community by reason of contamination or other condition of the property. So you've got dangerous property that's being condemned for one reason or another. The dash 7s picks up a concept that was discussed with respect to the constitutional provision. I can't remember if the constitutional draft we put before you, the amendments we had, actually had this language in it. But the concept is to indicate that a court would not defer to the public body's determination on whether or not a particular taking complies with the requirements of the operative provision of 3505, or with the exceptions that we provided here. In other words, the court is determined to look at it on its own to see if indeed the public body has complied with this section. And the reason for the concern is because many courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court in the Kelo case, do defer greatly to public bodies in these types of determination in the past, where they have said if the public body says there's a public purpose, they do give some deference to that determination. The language in the dash 7s would eliminate discretion. It would basically say, court, it's your job to look at this and determine whether or not this particular taking complied with the requirements of what would be in House Bill 3505. Dash 8 is simply a provision relating to applicability. It would indicate that the provisions of this section apply only to condemnations that are instituted on or after the effective date of the Act. So nothing in the bill would affect any pending condemnation action that might be out there. Dash nine amendments are a substitute for what is currently in lines 15 and 16 of the bill, which is the urban renewal provision. The bill currently indicates that the limitations of 3505 on condemnation won't apply to property within an urban renewal area that was purchased after the formation of an urban renewal plan for the area. And the intent behind this paragraph was to prevent speculation is what it was. The idea was that that if people were aware that a city or a county or any other local body was thinking about doing a urban renewal area, that speculators might move in and buy properties within the area and then rely on House Bill 3505's provision to simply say, you can't condemn this for me, you're going to have to pay my price if you want to have this as part of your urban renewal project. So that was the original purpose with subsection 2B in the bill at lines 15 and 16. There was concern about that because frequently there's a long public process before one of these plans are adopted. And the concern was is that 2B would not accomplish its purpose because by the time they got through the process, the speculators would have had plenty of time to go out and buy up such property as they might want to buy up and thus get to the position that provision was trying to prevent. The Dash 9 amendments gives the public bodies a way to avoid that result by allowing them to publish a notice that they are going to consider adoption of an urban renewal plan. And if they do that, if they go ahead and publish that notice, property that's acquired in those areas described in the notice and that are purchased after the notice is published will be not subject to the rule that's laid out in 3505, which is you can't condemn it even for the purpose of just turning it over to a private party. You should note about this provision that this does not prevent the city, this does not allow the city to do an urban renewal area under these statutes and force condemnation within those areas. In those areas, people who meet the requirements of 3505 will still be able to assert those rights if they own the property before this notice is published. And they would be able to say, no, if you're just acquiring it, turn it over to someone else, we are going to assert our 3505 right not to have that condemnation occur. Dash 10 is a general exception from the application of 3505 that would apply to unimproved land that zone on the effective date of this act for industrial use. So this would completely open up any land that's zoned on the effective date of the act for industrial use to this sort of they would be exempt from the limitation. Basically be able to condemn it the same way it's currently being condemned for any public purpose. And then finally, Dash 12 basically exempts property condemned by ports. I believe 778 is Port of Portland. I think 777 is ports generally. I'd have to go back and look, but I believe that's correct. So those are the amendments. I'd be happy to try to...
Members, do you have any questions of Mr. Hendricks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hendricks, there's been a lot of good work done here to identify problem areas that were created by the original bill and various exceptions and exemptions carved out. One of the issues that I'd raise, though, that I don't see addressed here at all, is that of the friendly condemnation, that is, that they're under federal income tax law, a person whose property is condemned can reinvest it without paying a capital gains tax. And I don't see anything in response to that concern, but I also suspect that maybe there's no fix for it. That is, that if we exempt a property from taking, then any taking that was invited by the property owner wouldn't be within that tax provision. Is that the reason why there's not a response to that problem here?
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, I believe that's correct. Other than our brief discussion in a meeting about a week ago, I have not had other folks come to me and come with a solution to this problem. I would say that it seems to me that with respect to the statutory prohibition, it could be possible that you could do a waiver of some sort. If you had a willing person saying, I'm willing to disregard this and sign an appropriate waiver for purposes of doing these friendly condemnations for the purposes of the tax consequences that follow, I'm not sure that this would be an absolute prohibition. If there was going to be a solution, that would be the solution, is to write in a provision for a waiver.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Could you expand just slightly on the rationale behind, for the record, on the 10, which is the industrial area, and the 12, which is the port?
I'd rather allow, Vice Chair Boquist, member of this committee, I think the proponents would be the best persons to do that. I wasn't part of the discussions on the rationale. I was the recipient of the language, so, and it makes sense. So.
Senator Starr?
Mr. Honeycutt, would you just address briefly those two amendments so that we understand the rationale, so when we go to explain this to our colleagues, we'll know what we're explaining.
Vice Chair Boquist, Members of Committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. The 10s, the purpose of the Dash 10 amendments were to resolve issue regarding the condemnation of industrial lands, the idea being that if these are undeveloped industrial lands, we're not talking about the little old widow in the residential neighborhood or Joe's garage shop in the commercial area, which is typically a target in other states of these condemnations, and the fact that they're the undeveloped as opposed to developed with, say, Joe's garage shop again, indicates that the primary purpose of having those lands is for something other than the operation of a small business or a residential area, and so that was the purpose for the 10s. The purpose of the 12s, for the record, is to address issues relating to condemnations by ports and port districts, we certainly don't have objection to those amendments. I'm not speaking for the senator or Senator Prezansky.
For the record, Bruce Starr, State Senator in District 15. I understand the Dash 10s were brought forward with the discussion that occurred with the chairman of the committee dealing with an issue that was brought before him. And as Mr. Honeycutt said, the Dash 12s deal with the ports. I think you heard testimony from the port districts about economic development issues and their mission and goals there. I think that I'm not going to oppose the Dash 12s. I don't know that they're absolutely necessary, but I think that in order to move this bill forward, I recommend that we adopt the amendments that are before you and we can continue to move forward. I will say that one of my slight frustrations in this process is that as we have moved this bill, you know, in the various hearings and work sessions, that it seems like just when we think we got it, somebody else says, well, you know, hey, what about my little issue? And I would just like to get the bill moving, and if there's legitimate issues that need to be resolved in this bill, we'll have another opportunity in the House committee or in the Senate committee potentially to do those. But I'd encourage this committee to adopt these amendments and move the bill forward so that we can have a shot at getting this bill done before sine die, hopefully next week. So for that, I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any other questions of these individuals? Comments of the committee on the amendments?
I will offer a comment, Mr. Vice Chair. As I said earlier in my interchange with Mr. Hendricks, I think that the bill is getting better. I think that it set off, though, on a sort of fundamentally wrong course. that is what is deeply troublesome to people about the case out of New London before the U.S. Supreme Court is the taking of property that belongs to long-time residents. In some instances, I think the plaintiff in the case was a person who had, for multi-generations, had lived in that home. And I think that's what sort of shocks the conscience. And we could have avoided a lot of the need for these the Swiss cheese kind of effect of these exceptions if we had focused in on the taking of residential property in a more narrow way to begin with. So I think we could have avoided the process we're going through here. And I am troubled about because of the issue that I had identified earlier, that we still don't have a mechanism to deal with friendly condemnations, and we're reacting to an incident that was 3,000 miles away in another state, and nobody has pointed to a live case that really brings forward those same kinds of concerns here in our state. So I think we have to run the risk of doing more harm by taking away a tax planning tool to Oregonians than we do positive for Oregonians by reacting to a fact pattern that arose far away. So I'm still continue to be troubled by the bill.
Okay. We're ready to start with the amendments.
Yeah.
On our side. Okay. If you're ready.
I'm ready.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the -3 amendment into 3503.
Representative Boquist has moved the -3 amendments into House Bill 3505. Objections? It's in.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to move the -4 into 3505.
And Representative Boquist has moved the -4s into 3505. Any objections?
Chair, move the -5 into 3505.
Boquist has moved the -5s into 3505. Any objections?
Chair, move the -6 into 3505.
Boquist has moved the -6 into 3505. Any objections? Therein.
Chair, I move the -7 into 3505.
Boquist has moved the -7s into 3505. Any objections?
Chair, I move the -8 into 3505.
Representative Boquist has moved the -8s into 3505. Any objections?
Chair, I move the -9 into 3505.
Representative Boquist has moved the -9s into 3505. Any objections?
Chair, I move the -10s into 3505.
Representative Boquist has moved the -10s into 3505. Any objections?
And finally, Mr. Chair, move the -12s into 3505.
Representative Boquist has moved the -12s into 3505. Any objections?
Therein. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move 3505 to the floor with a due pass as amended.
Representative Boquist has moved House Bill 3505 to the floor as amended with a due pass. Any objections? Representative Parker?
Briefly, discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you might recall, when that Supreme Court decision came down, I started working on drafting a bill to do this. And just because of some of the things that Representative McPherson mentioned, I'm going to be a soft no on this so that our colleagues will see that they need to take a look at it and possibly make the corrections. I think we'll make it even a better bill.
Okay, so noted. Any further? Can you call the roll, please?
Representative Barker?
No.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 3505, as amended, moves to the floor if you do pass. And we will have Representative Garrard and Boquist carry, please. Close the work session. Session on Senate Bill 1083.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1083A creates credit against personal and corporate income tax liability for increased labor costs associated with annual inflation based on increases in Oregon's minimum wage.
Fast. We had testimony on this bill, was it Thursday?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Thursday. There was some controversy, but
that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Boquist.
Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 1083 to the floor with a due pass.
Rev. Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1083A to the floor with a due pass.
You open for discussion, Mr. Chair? I guess I need sort of an update on what I think were some very troublesome issues that were identified over the cost of the bill before. My recollection is that we had a revenue analysis that said there was a certain level of revenue impact from the bill, and then we had advocates on behalf of the bill who were describing an interpretation of it that would have, I think, multiplied several times the revenue impact. So I want to get clarification on what the real revenue impact is of the bill.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, Paul Warner is here concerning the revenue impact in the bill, and he can address it better than I can.
I would like to hear from Mr. Warner.
A lot depends on the interpretation of the language.
Chair Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. There was a fair amount of discussion, as you recall, at the last meeting about the interpretation of who is eligible for the credit. There are really a couple of elements involved in that discussion. The two main ones was it limited to minimum wage workers only in agriculture. And the second issue was, did it deal with the annual increment only, or did it deal with the amount of minimum wage above the original base of $6.90 per hour? And what I've done is shown you the areas where discussion takes place under Senate Bill 1083 policy options. The first row there on minimum wage and annual increment only, that is as the Senate had interpreted it, in which you have about a $1.3 million impact in 2005-07. Keep in mind the credit is 50% in the first year, then it goes to 100% in 07 and beyond. There's been some discussion and some amendments, I believe, prepared on the minimum wage plus 50 cents, and I've looked at that, shown you that option. The largest impact would be in the case of all agricultural workers, and increases, cumulative increases from the base of $6.90 per hour. And you can see that in 2005-07, that would be for 1 year and a 50% credit, would be about $18 million. For 2007-09, that we estimate that would be $119 million impact from including all ag workers, of which we estimate there's 44,000, and a cumulative increase from $6.90 per hour. On the other side of the sheet there is just the raw data from Department of from Employment Department that shows you the workers by quarter wage categories for 2003, the last year we have real detailed data. This is where I've drawn these estimates from, and you can see that for workers over $10 an hour, there's a fair number in terms of the annual average in that sector. So under the broadest interpretation, including all ag workers, those workers would be eligible for the credit.
Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Well, there's quite a spread here, Mr. Warner. We've got an impact in the 07-09 biennium under one interpretation of $5.3 million, and under another interpretation, $119 million. And, well, I think that probably the first interpretation is the sounder one. It seems troublesome to me to pass a bill out that's subject to uncertainty over a delta of $114 million in the 07-09 biennium. How confident are you that it will be the Senate interpretation that will prevail?
Representative Pearson, Mr. Chair, I'm not real confident at all. I mean, this is really a discussion for legislative counsel in terms of how the language is interpreted in the bill. As I say, we had interpreted initially more narrowly in the initial context of that, but I think it's certainly, of course, I'm an economist and not a lawyer. I could see where it could be interpreted the other way as well. In terms of the impacts themselves, it's pretty straightforward. If I know the number of workers who are eligible, I know I've got a pretty good projection of what the minimum wage is going to be. I can make those estimates. But my expertise is not necessarily interpretation of the law, so I'll leave that up to counsel as to how they would define that and interpret between those issues. And I said, it's really two issues. It's whether you're going to include just minimum wage only or the minimum plus 50 cents, or you can include all ag workers. That's issue one. Issue two is, do you just include the incremental changes brought about by the indexing, or do you start from the 690 base and keep adding to that and use that as the basis for the credit? So, as you heard from your last testimony, you had two different interpretations of how it could be interpreted in law, and I would assume from that, if the Department of Revenue and use the interpretation as we have in this first row, the more narrow interpretation, there would be challenges to it.
Mr. Chair, I mean, this is a serious issue we've got before us. You know, $114 million in the state budget is a big dollar difference. Can we get Red Legislative Council in here to help us get comfort on this?
There he is.
Oh, we have him. We have legislative council here. Yeah, that's that. Right.
Mr. Chair, members, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office.
Okay. Mr. Johnson, thank you for coming forward. So what I want to know is if we were to pass the bill as it would pass the Senate, what is the risk that an interpretation other than the top line would be that it's 1.2 million in the current biennium and 5.3 million in the next biennium would be applied to this language?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I would say that there certainly is some legal risk that the larger revenue impact would be ultimately what the court would conclude the credit called for. As you're probably aware, the primary standard for judicial interpretation of statutes is the words used and not the legislative record that is built here. And the words used in subsection 2 of the bill talk about increases but do not mention annual increases. So it is certainly, there is a risk that, in fact, the court would construe that as meaning all increases from a period, either the effective date of the Act or the last date on which a minimum wage number was placed in the statute, which I think is $6.90 off the top of my head.
Okay. I don't have any other questions. Well, I do have a question, Mr. Chair. How hard would it be for us to amend the bill to clearly reflect the top line interpretation? I mean, how hard would it be for you to draft the amendment that would accomplish that result?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, it would not be difficult to do that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just to go back, Paul, just to confirm that line one of the impacts around here is the interpretation that Senator Deckard and the Revenue Committee took when it was in Senate Revenue?
Representative Boquist, the numbers there were the numbers that were in the revenue impact from the Senate That's correct.
Okay. Follow up? Sure. And I'm assuming, as if it's typical protocol, the Department of Revenue testified during this bill over there, too, or at least was consulted.
That's correct. Representative Boquist, we did talk with Department of Revenue, and they had a similar interpretation.
Okay, thank you.
Any further? By way of discussion?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, I can't vote for a bill that is subject to a $114 million swing in its revenue impact in the next biennium out, not to mention a swing in the current biennium of over $17 million that we could fix if we sent back legislative counsel back to fix it and bring it back here tomorrow. I'll support the top line. I think our farmers need some help on minimum wage impacts. We are not competitive in a global marketplace, but for us to pass a bill out that's already passed the Senate, so if it gets a majority on the floor, it's onto the governor's desk. It's one signature away from producing an impact that's wildly different in its revenue impact. I can't support the bill, though, and it's subject to that kind of uncertainty. I think we have a duty to the citizens of Oregon to get it right, more right than that.
We're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1083. And we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 899.
Yes. Mr. Chair, the committee has heard this bill before on SB 899, and before you have the -12 amendments, and they come as a result of a work group addressing issues relating to Washington County. Is a compromise affecting any county, and it does not include excluding Multnomah County from the current TSCC requirements.
Any discussion on the -12s?
I just need to make sure I get oriented here. So the -12s would effectively exempt the counties that are now under $500,000 people in population, but retain the commission for Multnomah County, which is the one county above?
Correct.
Okay.
And then allows a second option for how they can report. If the county opts not to have the TSCC, they can report the various districts so the public can have access to that information freely.
Right, but the sort of bottom line is among the counties, Multnomah County is required to continue
right
to having their commission, and the other counties are out unless they opt in.
An option, correct.
Right. Just by ready for discussion, Mr. Chair.
And there are no objections from Multnomah County regarding having a TSCC. The survey said they liked having it. I think it was 18 districts that gave you information from the last time we met from Multnomah County.
Well, let me follow up on that if I could, Mr. Chair. Multnomah County, which is paying for the commission,
correct,
objects.
Yes, Multnomah County.
The other taxing authorities in Multnomah County, many of them said they like it.
Yes.
I wonder how they'd feel if they were paying the bill. for the commission. That's a rhetorical question. You don't have to answer.
I don't want to answer on behalf of this.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A-12s into Senate Bill 899.
Ruby Boquist has moved the A-12 amendments into Senate Bill 899. Objections?
I do object, Mr. Chair, for the reason I've discussed before. I think that we should have one policy for all counties, and only we ought to single out one county and say you're subject to something the other counties are not going to be subject to.
So noted. Anything further? The amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 899 be amended with a due pass recommendation and then the subsequent referral to revenue be rescinded.
Ruben Boquist moves that Senate Bill 899 be amended with a due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to revenue be rescinded. Discussion on the motion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative
Lopez?
Aye.
Representative Torres?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 899 is amended with a due pass and closed to the floor with a subsequent referral to revenue has been rescinded.
Somebody not vote on my count?
Okay. Representative Flores will carry.
Oh, here comes my favorite one.
Close the work session on 899. Open a work session on Senate Bill 408.
Move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 408.
Representative Holquist moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 408. We passed Senate Bill 408 to the floor last week. I ask that it be brought back to the committee before the floor debate to consider amending the bill with the -22 amendments. Are there any objections to Representative Holquist's motion to suspend the rules?
Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 408.
Representative Boquist moves that we reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 408. Any objections? So ordered. Senate Bill 408 is back before the committee.
Chair, I move the B-22 amendments to Senate Bill 408.
Representative Boquist has moved the B-22 amendments into Senate Bill 408. Any objections?
Mr. Chair, I need to understand the B-22s more fully before I would be able to vote effectively on this. Okay. I need an explanation of them and how they tie in with the constitutional issues that we were wrestling with before.
Representative, you can explain the B-22. Have Mr. Nelson come up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing industrial customers of Northwest Utilities and a coalition of business associations in support of the -22 amendments. Michael Early is the executive director of ICNU, and he'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. gentlemen, there was a the work that had resulted in the version of the bill that was reported out of this committee before was attempting to deal with what I understood to be constitutional issues about a situation in which there was asymmetry, that is, or that maybe, to use a sort of a slang characterization, sort of a heads I win, tails you lose proposition in the way that the bill had come over from the Senate. That is, a reanalysis, an adjustment to rates that could only go one direction. And is that still, is that a problem, or is that an issue, or is that a characterization that is one would then put on the B-22s, that is, that the adjustment that's made is only one that favors ratepayers and rather than the utility if it were the comparison were to go the other direction?
The B-22 amendments provide for adjustments to the rate either up or down, so it is symmetrical in terms of adjusting increasing rates or decreasing rates. The fundamental difference between the B-20 and the B-22 is what the target of the automatic adjustment clause is, and specifically in the context of a utility that is owned by a parent, and the parent files on a consolidated tax basis. What B-20 said was the adjustment would attempt to true up the taxes collected from Oregon ratepayers with the total consolidated tax bill of the entity. So, for example, if one of our utilities was owned by an out-of-state entity that was engaged in very profitable unregulated businesses, the commission, the Oregon Public Utilities Commission, could include in rates, say, $50 million that would recover from Oregon citizens. But the parent chooses to file on a consolidated basis. It's very profitable. And let's say its income tax liability is $500 million. It's 10 times the amount that is recovered from utility customers in rates. What B-20 says in that case is that the rates would be adjusted through this automatic adjustment clause so that ratepayers would be responsible for that difference between the $500 million and the $50 million, or an additional $450 million. Now, that doesn't happen automatically. There are provisions that allow the commission to step in and apply the same standards they apply today in terms of just and reasonable. What's different about our bill is our bill gets to the heart of the question. In that same fact situation, what we're truing up is we're saying we want to match the dollars collected from ratepayers with the dollars, tax dollars paid by the utility and attributable to regulated operations. So the commission looks at the $500 million and asks itself what portion of that $500 million was attributable to regulated operations in Oregon, and that answer is going to be, it's going to be $50 million. So then it says, well, it did collect and did pay to taxing authorities the amount of taxes collected. So in that case, the adjustment is, there would be no adjustment, because in fact, what was expected to happen did happen. It collected $50 million, and it paid $50 million.
Go on, Mr. Chair. What about the scenario in which there's a graduated tax effect and the effect of consolidation causes that income that was generated out of the regulated operations to then be subject to a higher rate because it's combined in with a larger base of income, so that in effect the consolidation causes the income that was generated out of regulated operations to be taxed at a higher rate than it would have been if it were just a standalone investor-owned utility?
Well, again, that's a judgment for the commission to make under our bill. The starting point in our bill is it looks at, for the parent, it says, how much tax did the parent pay? And that's, you look at the check. And then the commission asks itself, how much of that tax is attributable to the regulated operations of the utility? And that's the job of the commission. That's the sort of decisions it makes, and as you point out, it's fact fact-specific and not something that can be dealt with legislatively in minute detail. So that is a decision for the commission to make. And after it makes that decision, then it compares that number, you know, the amount of that $500 million attributable to the utility with the amount of tax that was collected in the same year through rates. And then it makes the adjustment up or down to the rates, depending on whether it under-collected or over-collected.
Mr. Chair, recall we had input from DOJ, from particularly Pete Shepard, on the prior version of the bill that we moved out of committee. And I'm wondering, is there anyone here from, we have somebody from DOJ. I wonder if we could hear from DOJ about...
Representative McPherson, there's been 13 hours in your work group, about 6 hours in here, and we could talk on this bill for another year, and I'm not certain... Right. That we would get the two sides together, or we would get the opinions of the attorneys together.
Yeah, no,
I don't think that I can go there.
Okay.
I think we've gotten to the point where I think I made a statement that there was no position of right on this bill that I could define down to where I was comfortable. And I think everybody understands it's going to end up in court.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the further attorneys will make determinations far beyond what we can.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that.
And I understand your position.
I don't want to impede the process. I was trying to understand what the Dash 22 amendments do. I would say there is another solution to the problem. I know I would keep going back there. Senator Representative Barker and I have advanced that hasn't gotten any traction, but it would be a good, simple solution to this problem. It wouldn't be dragged through all this complexity, but I will.
I wouldn't be surprised that when the time is right, we'll receive traction.
Okay, I appreciate your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
We're on the B-22.
Yeah, we're on the B-22s. I'd like to have a motion to put them into the bill.
Already made it.
You did.
That's what we're discussing. I thought we discussed it before making it. No, I made the motion and then we brought the bill.
Okay, we had the discussion on the motion to have the amendments in. We heard the objection. They are in.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 408 as amended to the floor with a due pass. I'm looking here.
No, there is no referral.
And the subsequent referral to budget be rescinded. It's on there.
Okay. Representative Bocas has moved Senate Bill 408 as amended with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to budget be rescinded. Any discussion?
Just to note, Mr. Chair, I was a supporter of the bill as it came out of the committee before. I'll be a no vote today because it's veered off so that it's not a middle ground. Given that it's, I think, the wrong way of trying to solve the problem, it's also not in the middle ground of the solution. So I think that we should not, cannot support the version of the bill we're moving today.
Okay. So in order.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 408 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass. Representative Boquist will be the carrier. I hope you have help on the floor.
Sure.
Hopefully the good representative across from me will send the questions in advance.
I think arrangements are being made from another individual to do the same.
Okay, and I commit to you I will do that.
I don't mind a friendly ambush, okay?
Just be like Dalton.
Yeah, I really should do it.
I could. Well, hers, I mean, this is just every time. How many have to do? It's quite often before I have to see what she's
doing. Yeah, I would do that to Jerry. You can always get a picture. I would not generally. You know, I just.
Boy, he was in this band. He was human.
Open work session on Senate Bill 303.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 303, as you recall, abolishes the Insurance Pool Governing Board and creates the Office of Private Health Partnerships. The bill also outlines many of the administrative aspects of the transfer of the name and the dissolving of the IPGB. On Friday, the 21st of July, we adopted the Dash 1 amendments. You may recall that. What we have before us today are the Dash 2 amendments, which resolve conflicts. Conflicts being current bills that have not been enacted that make reference to the Insurance Pool Governing Board. This rectifies it to, it resolves the conflict, changing it to the new name of the Office of Private Health Partnerships. Mr. Chair, this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means that we have approval to rescind.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 conflict amendments into SB 303.
Boquist has moved the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 303. And any objections? Therein.
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate Bill 303 to the floor with a do pass and a rescinding of the Ways and Means referral.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 303 as amended to the floor with a do pass. Rescinding the referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion, objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Excuse.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 303, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass. And Representative McPherson, would you carry?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Close the work session. Open a work session on House Bill 3507.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We heard testimony on this bill last Thursday, July 21st. This would increase mandatory minimum sentences and extend periods of post-prison supervision for persons convicted of rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, or unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree. There is a Dash 1 amendment before the committee that the proponents supported that would simply increase the mandatory minimum sentences from 100 months to 300 months when the victim is under 12 years of age. It excludes from the mandatory minimum sentences the increases if committed by a defendant under 18 years of age, and then it also establishes the authority for lifetime post-prison supervision and requires the active tracking of persons on post-prison supervision that the original bill required.
We do have the Dash 1 if we need to get that.
Representative Cameron. For the record, Representative Kevin Cameron, District 19, and Representative Smith had to move on. I volunteered to stay here and answer any questions that you might have about in regards to the bill. It's the same bill that we heard last week, same amendments.
Okay. Any questions?
I just want to reconfirm, Mr. Chair, Dash 1 amendment.
Dash 1, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Chair, I have a question. I think it's for staff rather than for Representative Cameron, and that is, this is a major increase in the mandatory minimums for certain offenses, and it obviously will have a, just intuitively, it looks like it would have a major fiscal impact, at least out of ways, because of the length of these sentences already. What information do we have about the fiscal impact?
Representative McPherson and members of the committee, I have been in contact with John Borden from Legislative Fiscal. You're correct that the Department of Corrections fiscal impact is going to occur 8-plus years down the line, because already persons who commit this crime are getting 100 months. So as you know, that does not figure into the fiscal impact for this legislative session. Additionally, the Public Defense Services Commission expressed some concern about the number of cases that may end up being in trial, but the Legislative Fiscal determined that it's just too indeterminate to put a price tag on it, and therefore they said that there did not need to be a referral to the Budget Committee.
Yeah, I understand what you just said. That it would be, it's because it's too far out in the future, or it's too uncertain about what its impact would be?
Both, Representative McPherson. The Department of Corrections impact is too far out in the future to be considered. There are other pieces. I mean, anytime you have a case that's going to increase penalties like this, you, I think, increase the possibility that a person accused of the crime is going to go to trial. But that is indeterminate, and therefore the referral to budget is not necessary.
Mm-hmm. Okay. For your information also, Senator Burdick, I think I mentioned to you, we're going to put a work group like we did with the meth package together and look at that whole litany of statutes. Mr. Taylor is gathering everything together already.
Mr. Chair, I applaud that. I mean, the biggest problem we've got with our system of criminal justice, I think, is that we're so reactive to individual concerns, like we're not being stern enough with particular offenders.
Comprehensive look at the whole thing.
Yeah, no,
sentencing programs for recovery, which ones are appropriate, and is there some place we've gone beyond what we should?
Yeah, and I guess then the question is, should we be passing a bill like this that's sort of a dealing with one issue that's to has these impacts that would fall further in the future before we undertake that? I mean, I greatly encourage that effort, because I think that's what we clearly need. But this ought to be folded into that analysis, the issue that's addressed in this bill.
I think right now there's a huge amount of sentiment to do something the best we can, realizing that, as with the meth package and other big programs, we're going to have to revisit it, and it's going to be an unfolding event. Mm-hmm. I would think that's what's going to happen.
Well, I think just to sort of register the concern about how things are evolving, I'll oppose the bill, but I understand that sentiment that's driving the concern in this particular case.
Okay. Any questions of Representative Cameron?
Chair, I move the -1 amendment into 3507.
Representative Boquist has moved the -1 amendments into House Bill 3507. Objections?
Yeah, just for the record, Mike.
For the record, Representative McPherson. Okay, the amendments are in.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3507 to the floor with a due pass
as amended.
As amended.
Representative Boquist has moved House Bill 3507 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative,
I'd just like
Parker.
To say, we've talked quite a bit about the very costly, how much it costs to keep people in prison. An adult who molests a child under 12, it's cheap insurance to have that creep locked up. And I think it's a worthwhile expenditure to do that in these cases. These people are repeat, and the victimization is just beyond counting. And the problem is that, as we all know, molested children don't get over that. And then many of them become molesters and so on. And if we can save some of them, I think that we're getting off really cheap by locking them up.
So noted. Further?
I suppose to respond to that comment, Mr. Chair, what we need is to look at our Department of Corrections facilities as an expensive resource, and it may well be that these long sentences are the right solution for this particular kind of category of offense, but we need to take a look at where we're going to get those jail beds from, rather than just deciding we're going to build more prisons and pressure our general fund further. So we need that comprehensive look that you were indicating would be undertaken.
Okay. Okay. Call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Moquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 3507 is amended. Moves to the floor with a due pass. And Representative Smith will be, Patty Smith will be the carrier. Close the work session. Open a work session on Senate Bill 907.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Before we get started, I have a little presentation for the chair from the Judiciary Committee staff in honor of Representative Krieger's smurfing adventure with Representative McPherson and Senators Burdick and Beyer. We wanted to give you this Papa Smurf doll, and as you can see, he's holding boxes of pseudoephedrine-based products. So, to remember your little trip by. And I can take no credit for it. Patsy gets all the credit for that find.
Senator Burdick wouldn't have had anything to do with this.
I sit in the back of the office. I don't know anything about Senator Burdick's involvement.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 907 is the Senate half of the methamphetamine package worked on by yourself, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, and Senators Burdick and Beyer. This half of the package modifies the crimes of criminal mistreatment in the first degree and child neglect in the first degree to include leaving an individual in a place where methamphetamine is manufactured. It modifies the definition of abuse to include exposure to controlled substances and clarifies the court's ability to suspend child visitation if the parent's controlled substance abuse is not in the best interest of the child. It elevates on the sentencing guidelines grid manufacture of methamphetamine to level 8. It creates a new sentencing scheme for certain repeat methamphetamine offenders. It authorizes the Department of Corrections to modify programs based on need for drug treatment. It separates the drug statute into multiple statutes based on whether it's a manufacture, a delivery, or a possession, and what type of controlled substance is being manufactured, delivered, or possessed. And that's done so that in the future, statistical tracking will be easier. And then it goes on through several of the last pages to make conforming changes based on that separation of the drug statute. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. There is no amendments pending. This did come to the committee with a subsequent referral to budget, but after speaking to Mr. Anderson in the Speaker's office, because there is the companion budget bill already in the budget committee, it is appropriate for this committee to rescind the referral to budget upon contemplating action.
Mm-hmm. Committee members, Rosie McPherson, you were on the work group. We spent, I don't know, what, 8 or 10 different days that we worked on the bill part-time. Heidi spent probably 60, 70, 80 hours, maybe more. I know some weekends.
Yep.
It passed out of the Senate, I believe, 30 zip. I think it's a good piece of work. You and I will be the carriers when we get there in a minute.
Be delighted to do that,
and
Mr. Chair.
I think we need to stress again the fact that we enhance penalties, but we also recognize that part of the incentive to doing that not only was protecting the public, but it was for the purpose of having our hands on people for the length of time to get them into recovery programs, and also on the post-release that you'd have your hands on them, and if they didn't do the release program, you could put them back in prison. I think we made a giant step, and I really applaud the two senators that helped us with the bill and the work that you did.
I think, Mr. Chair, just if I could comment, I think that this package of legislation that this is half of is one of the real highlights of this session, and not only in the quality of the result, but in the way it was brought forward in a bipartisan way, bicameral way, to solve a problem in dealing with I think, looking at what are the real impacts we can have on improving the situation for Oregonians.
When the bill, just talked to us a minute about 2485, when it was on the floor, I don't know if anyone talked to you, but I had numerous D's and R's saying it was the first time this session that they didn't feel it was a DNR. Mm-hmm. Nobody was positioning themselves for the next election. They were doing what they felt was right regardless of the consequences of their election. Isn't that great that we would do that?
You're here.
Kind of what the public might expect, I would hope. So I really appreciate your time and your work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Likewise.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 907 with a do-pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to budget be rescinded.
Rick Bocas has moved Senate Bill 907 to the floor with a do-pass and the subsequent referral to budget be rescinded. Any discussion on the motion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Bocas.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Krieger.
Aye. Senate Bill 907 moves the floor with a brief pass, and Representative McPherson and I will carry. And before we close, I want to serve notice that having voted on the prevailing side on Senate Bill 548, I serve notice of possible reconsideration of the bill. Any other discussions? We're set up for what time tomorrow, Heidi?
You know, I don't know the answer.
I think one o'clock was it?
No, well, we're meeting.
Four sessions at one.
Yeah. So we're talking about 9.
Yeah, we're going to move it up till 9 and move everything we can that was on the agenda that was posted. That'll get us some things done. Session's late tomorrow, and I'll be meeting with staff on the few more bills that we've got to get on within the next day.
So 9 a.m. is when we'll be meeting back here on the committee. Okay.
Which one? This is that one where we remove it from the consent calendar and put it.
You don't have to.
He knows.
Okay. We're finished. Thank you.